We got to the point in Matthew's account, chapter 12, and verse 10, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath days that they might accuse him? And in response to that, although it's not recorded by Matthew, if we go to Luke's account in chapter 6, you remember the master had referred them to the fact in verse 3 of Luke chapter 6, have you not read so much as what David did when he himself was hungered? And at the end of the class last time, we were looking at 1 Samuel chapter 21 to see that David indeed had, with his men, partaken of the showbread, which it was unlawful for them to eat. And the master was not denying the fact that it was unlawful. What he was wanting them to appreciate is why hadn't they condemned David for doing something which was unlawful? And I think we established also from 1 Samuel 21 that he had done it on the Sabbath day. So why was it that they hadn't accused David of breaking the Sabbath law, and yet they were accusing him and his disciples of doing that very thing? And I believe the answer which the master wanted them to appreciate is in Mark's record in chapter 2. And we shall need this week, as we did last time, a marker or our fingers in Matthew 12, Mark 2 and 3, and Luke chapter 6, because we'll have to compare the records, because each of the gospel writers adds a wee bit to the narrative. And I believe the emphasis in verse 25 is, have you never read what David did when he had need and was an hungered, he and they that were with him? The need outweighed the formalism of the law. The master wasn't condoning David. He didn't say he was doing something which was right when in fact it was unlawful. He acknowledged he was doing something unlawful, but the need at that time was sufficient to outweigh the fact that technically he was breaking the law concerning the showbread. And I believe what the master was emphasising is that the formalism of the law needed at all times to be balanced by the spirit of the law, and that where there was a need was to outweigh the actual ritual. And I believe implied in this is that we will sometimes in our lives come across a principle where to uphold one aspect of the teaching of the master, or a law for want of a word, has to be broken in order to keep another law. And I believe that the principle there is, if keeping of one commandment involves breaking another, the fulfilling of the higher one must be the priority. For example, we all have a duty and a responsibility to honour father and mother. That is a responsibility which is placed upon us. I do not believe personally, and I think we can justify from the scriptures, that that is solely within the bonds of the covenant. I believe that naturally as well, even if our parents are outside the truth, we still have the obligation and the responsibility to honour father and mother. But if in upholding that, we're asked to do something contrary to what the Lord Jesus has taught in another matter, then sometimes it will be necessary to override what has been instructed perhaps by parents in order to uphold what the master is teaching. We also have that in some of the words of the Apostle Paul, whereby we are subject to the authorities of this land. And we are told quite specifically to be law-abiding citizens. But if They ask us to do something which is contrary to what the Master has taught or what the Word of God instructs. Then we have the right to obey what has been required and not obey the laws of this land. So it's always the fact that the higher law, for want of a term, takes priority if, of necessity, we have to break, in vertomers, a lesser law. In other words, it's the spirit which is more important rather than the actual letter. And this is what we will see. So whereas the Master doesn't condone David, he does say there was a great need. And because of that, the actual ritual of partaking of the showbread, which was unlawful, was secondary to the fact that he had a need. And the Master is duly applying to the fact there that even if the disciples had technically broken the Sabbath law, their need, the hunger, was necessary, overriding the ritual. If you'd like to go back to Matthew chapter 12, the Master then says, in verse 5, "And have you not read in the law how that on the Sabbath days the priests in the temple profane the Sabbath and are blameless?" And it's Matthew which adds that comment to reinforce his argument. The priests were working on the Sabbath day. There was no question about that. Nobody could deny that. So if work was not acceptable to the Sadducees and the Pharisees on the Sabbath day in any sense whatsoever, how could the priests be blameless? Because they were working. Not only so, if you look, for example, in Numbers chapter 28, in Numbers chapter 28, we are given a list of some of the duties of the priests as they were to serve in the tabernacle. And they were told that they'd got to offer us certain offerings day by day, a burnt offering being one of them. But in verse 9 of Numbers 28, "And on the Sabbath day, two lambs of the first year without spot and 2/10 deals of fowl for a meal offering had to be offered on the Sabbath day as compared to one during the week." So God was doubling the amount of work which had to be done by the priests on the Sabbath day. So rather than lessening the work and telling them they didn't have to work on the Sabbath because otherwise they would be breaking the law, he actually doubled the amount of work which the priests had to perform on the Sabbath day. And the Master wanted them to appreciate, well, how could they be blameless? Makes us reflect, brothers and sisters, when on our Sabbath, do we do twice as much work for the Lord than we do during the week? But that's something we have to consider for ourselves. The point which the Master was saying, how are they blameless? They're blameless because obviously the true understanding of why the Sabbath was instituted was being upheld by the priests. And we shall see that in a second. But coming back to Matthew chapter 12, he then says in verse 6, "But I say unto you that in this place is one greater than the temple." Now you'll notice the word "one" is in italics, not there in the original. And what the Master is literally saying, "I say unto you that in this place is greater than the temple." What was happening in that place where he was, which was greater than the temple? There was more true worship of God taking place there and then than was being conducted and enacted in the temple. And therefore it was the true spirit of worship which I believe the Master is speaking of in verse 6. Now I know later on he attributes these things to himself. In this context, I do not think he is. I think he's talking about the arena, the very place that he was, that he was saying that in this place is something happening which is greater than what's happening in the temple. There is more being done for true worship than in the temple. And if you think that by rubbing ears of corn that breaks the law, and therefore what we are doing is not acceptable, in verse 7, if you had known what this meaneth, I will have mercy and not sacrifice, you would not have condemned the guiltless. Now we've seen that quotation from Hosea chapter 6 many times. It's the spirit which is more important than the letter. Sacrifices were commanded by God to be offered. It was a law. It was something which was written in their constitution that they should do. But to obey was better than sacrifice. And therefore it was better to have mercy rather than sacrifice. And therefore it was necessary to obey the word of God. That was more to him than a multitude of sacrifices. So in the temple, they might be going through the rituals and therefore being pedantic to make sure they didn't do anything which was wrong. But they missed the whole spirit of the true worship of God. In this place, without all the trappings, without any altar, without any of the ceremonies which were going on in the temple, there was more true worship being enacted in the spirit of what God required than in the temple. And therefore he looks back and he said, how were the priests blameless? How was David blameless? Because they understood what the Sabbath law was all about. So if we can come back to Mark's Gospel now, and verse 27, he sums up his thoughts by saying, the Sabbath was made for man, and not man for the Sabbath. The Sabbath was designed as a rest from normal works, in order that they may concentrate their hearts and minds in the worship and working for God. It was a time of spiritual refreshing, a time when they could rest from their natural labours so that they could give undivided attention to the things of God. It was a day when they should rejoice and be joyful in the things of God without having their minds cluttered with the everyday events of life. But of course man had added to it and therefore had taken away the effectiveness of the Sabbath. If we can just give you a couple of quotations, let's go back to Exodus 23. Exodus chapter 23, verse 12. 6 days thou shalt do thy work, and on the Sabbath day thou shalt rest, that thine ox and thine ass may rest, and the son of thine handmaid and the son of the stranger may be refreshed. So everybody was ceasing from natural work in order that they indeed might concentrate their hearts and minds upon the things of God and be refreshed from the things of the toil and labour of every day. Just go through to Deuteronomy chapter 5, and again, same idea is seen. Verse 13, Deuteronomy 5, 6 days thou shalt labour, do all thy work. The seventh is the Sabbath of the Lord thy God. In it thou shalt not do any work, that at the end of that verse, you may, that all your servants may rest as well as thou. And it's that time when they could reflect upon the fact that they could remember in verse 15 that thou wast a servant in the land of Egypt. The Lord thy God brought thee out thence through a mighty hand by a stretched out arm. Therefore the Lord thy God commanded thee to keep the Sabbath day. So with their minds refreshed, with the toil of everyday life ceasing, they could concentrate their whole heart and mind upon what God has done for them in redeeming them out of the house of bondage and sin and death, to give them that exalted position in his sight. And in essence, brothers and sisters, that's what we do on the first day of the week. We remember what God has done for us in causing us to come out of the land of bondage, a land of sin and death, in order that indeed we might be an exalted people in his sight. And I believe the principle of resting and shutting out and getting rid of all the clutter which fills our minds day by day, so that we can concentrate on that day above all the other days. I'm not trying to say we should be a one day a week Christadelphia, but during the rest of the week we have to work, because we know what the exhortation of the apostles are. If we don't work, then obviously we're worse than an infidel. But just one day we can concentrate our hearts and our minds upon those things which God has done for us, that we may be refreshed in the things which belong unto him. And so coming back to Mark chapter 2 and verse 27, he says, Sabbath was made for man and not man for the Sabbath. Therefore, the Son of Man is Lord also of the Sabbath. And the way I read verse 28, brothers and sisters, is the emphasis that the Son of Man is Lord also of the Sabbath. Because in verse 27, if the Sabbath was made for man, the Son of Man is Lord of the man. And because the Sabbath is for the benefit of the man, being Lord of the man, he is also Lord of the Sabbath. In other words, the Sabbath is subject to the man, not man being subject to the Sabbath. And therefore, what they were looking at, brothers and sisters, was the wrong way round. They assumed that man had to conform to the Sabbath. The Sabbath was there so that man could enjoy the benefits of that specific day, so that he might be refreshed in the things of God. Therefore, he says, because of what he says in verse 27, the Son of Man, being Lord of the man, is therefore also of the Sabbath, for whose benefit the Sabbath was. Son of Man, Daniel chapter 7 again, we've seen that on a number of occasions. He uses the expression Son of Man because of the Ancient of Days prophecy in Daniel chapter 7. And I think we've seen that on numerous occasions. Case was now rested. How could they argue? Where was there any fault in his reasoning? None at all. Because the whole tenor of the Old Testament scriptures saw the benefit of the Sabbath law as far as man was concerned. And therefore the doing of good, the initiating of the spirit of things rather than the letter, the fact that priests worked, David partook of things which were unlawful when there was a need, overrode every ritual as far as they were trying to uphold. So there's only one thing I want to just finally on this matter think about with you, and that's verse 26. Because he made the point that David went into the house of God in the days of Abiathar the high priest. And yet we had seen back in 1 Samuel chapter 21 that it was Ahimelech who David went into. Now for those who are listening on tape, we've had the benefit of those who are here tonight at the class to ask them their opinions before we're going to make a comment. One opinion was that Abiathar was indeed the high priest. Ahimelech, being his son, was simply doing the job on behalf of his father. Would that be fair? Yes? Would that be, I think. The second opinion was the expression used in verse 26, that Jesus, speaking of David, that David went into the house of God in the days of Abiathar the high priest. That the master wasn't being specific that it was Abiathar who he saw, but it was in the times of Abiathar the high priest. There is another principle of that. If we can go to Matthew chapter 1, and verse 11, when Josias begat Jeconias and his brethren about the time that they were carried away to Babylon. Now obviously there are a few kings missing as far as the genealogy are concerned, because as we know it was not in the days of Jeconias when they were carried away into Babylon, but it was about the time. And in the long history of the kings of Judah, Matthew was just giving us an approximation. So that the master in chapter 2 of Mark in verse 26 was approximating that it was in the days of Abiathar the high priest, because that was the more important priest of the times, not necessarily specifically the one that David saw. Would that be fair, Gordon? Yeah. Yeah. That was the sort of two opinions. I'm going to suggest a third one, and then everyone can make up their minds. You'll notice in your margin, I'll reference, your central margin, by the phrase Abiathar the high priest, that he gives us three quotations. 1 Chronicles 24 and 2 Samuel chapter 8 are basically talking of the same thing. So if we just go back to 1 Chronicles chapter 24, 1 Chronicles 24 and 2 Samuel 8 are basically saying the same thing. And that is, looking at 1 Chronicles 24 and verse 6, and Shemaiah, the son of Nethaneel, the scribe, one of the Levites, wrote them before the king and the princes, and Zadok the priest, and Ahimelech the son of Abiathar. So what 1 Chronicles 24 tells us, and what 2 Samuel chapter 8 tells us, is that Abiathar, in verse 6, was the father of Ahimelech. So you've got Ahimelech, the son of Abiathar. If we go back to 1 Samuel, this time chapter 22, which is the reference which Mark doesn't give us, or with the translators doesn't give us in the central margin. In 1 Samuel 22 and verse 20, and one of the sons of Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub, was named Abiathar, and escaped and fled after David. So this time it reverses it. Instead of telling us, as we've got it in 1 Chronicles chapter 24, that Ahimelech was the son of Abiathar, here it says, and one of the sons of Elimelech was named Abiathar. If you take that back to 1 Samuel chapter 14, and verse 3, it speaks of this Ahiah in verse 3, which would seem to be Ahimelech. 1 Samuel 14 verse 3, and Ahiah, or your margin says Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub, Ichabod's brother, etc. So you will find that in Samuel, one way they are spoken of as one being the son of the other, and then reversed. My suggestion is they both had got the same names. That we had got both named Ahimelech and Abiathar, and then reversed for the son, Abiathar and Ahimelech. In other words, I don't believe there is a contradiction in 1 Samuel 22 and 1 Chronicles chapter 24. I believe that father and son had the same name, which was not uncommon. So when the master speaks of Abiathar in chapter 2 and verse 26, he used one of the two names. Now whether the first suggestion, that it was the father, Abiathar, and therefore Ahimelech was similarly carrying out the work of the son, or, as Brother Gordon suggested, he was speaking just in the days of Abiathar, or the suggestion which I made, whichever one is true, what I will say categorically, brothers and sisters, is that what the master says was right. And the reason I say that is not only because he would always tell the truth and in his knowledge of Scripture was beyond doubt. If you think what he'd said, coming back to Mark chapter 2 and verse 25, he said unto them, "Have you never read what David did when he went into the house of God in the days of Abiathar the high priest?" So he was rebuking them for not understanding and even suggesting they haven't read the scriptures properly. That obviously hurt. That was a stinging rebuke to them. So if there was a chink in the armour of the master, that he'd got the name wrong, immediately they would have responded and said, "You accuse us of not reading. You can't even quote properly. It's not Abiathar at all, it's Ahimelech." There was no response from them. There was no word from them whatsoever. So whichever way it is to be understood, clearly it was accepted by them all. Either that, or we've got to assume none of them had read and they didn't even know what the master was saying. And I don't think that could be true. I think they would have been very quick on the uptake to say, "You've got it wrong. You say we haven't read, you read it again." Therefore, whatever it was, whichever of the three suggestions you want to accept, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, acknowledge that what the master said was true, was accepted by them. Anyway, something for us to think about, and perhaps for those who will be here later, we can sort of chew that one over in the discussion. Right. Can we then move on? And I'd like us to go back to Luke's account, chapter 6. Because, as we suggested right at the beginning of our consideration of the life of the Lord, it is Luke, more than anyone else of the Gospel writers, who wants to set in order the things that were written. So chronologically, Luke tends to follow more in sequence than any of the Gospel writers. So we'll get back to Luke chapter 6. Verse 5 concludes what we've just discussed, that the Son of Man is Lord also on the Sabbath. That in verse 6, he goes on to say now, "And it came to pass also on another Sabbath that he entered into the synagogue and taught. And there was a man whose right hand was withered. And the scribes and the Pharisees watched him, whether he would heal on the Sabbath day, that they might find an accusation against him. But he knew their thoughts, and said to the man which had the withered hand, "Rise up, and stand forth in the midst." And he arose and stood forth. Then said Jesus unto them, "I will ask you one thing. Is it lawful on the Sabbath day to do good or to do evil, to save life or to destroy it?" And looking around about upon them all, he said unto the man, "Stretch forth thy hand." And he did so, and his hand was restored whole as the other. And they were filled with madness and communed one with another what they might do to Jesus. So as we commented last time, the master didn't try to ease the problem as to whether it was lawful to do things on the Sabbath day. He constantly almost was provoking them into challenging him concerning this Sabbath day. For the very next thing that happened after the controversy of his disciples robbing corn on the Sabbath day was to centre around another incident on the Sabbath day. And we commented about that last time. Now, for those who want to keep the references, we've got to compare Luke chapter 6 now, verse 6 to 11, as we've just read, with Matthew chapter 12, verses 9 to 14, and Mark chapter 3 and verses 1 to 6. All three synoptic gospel writers give us the account of the healing of the man with the withered hand, following on after the controversy concerning the Sabbath. It was now again the Sabbath day. The master was in the synagogue. Which synagogue, we're not told. My suggestion would be, brethren and sisters, as we said when he was going back from Jerusalem and his disciples were in the field, he was making his way back to Galilee. And therefore, because it doesn't tell us any different, I would suggest he was now back in what had become his adopted hometown of Capernaum, and it would have been in the synagogue in Capernaum that he would have cured this man with a withered hand. It was obviously his custom to enter on the Sabbath day into the synagogue to teach and to preach. And I would suggest that it was the Capernaum synagogue in which he'd entered. And if we come to Mark's account in chapter 3 and verse 1, Mark makes the point, and he entered again into the synagogue. Now, if you remember back to chapter 2 of Mark and verse 1, when he healed the man sick of the palsy, that took place in Capernaum, and I suggested to you at that time it took place in the synagogue in Capernaum. And I gave various reasons. Mark and verse 1. When he healed the man sick of the palsy, that took place in Capernaum, and I suggested to you at that time it took place in the synagogue in Capernaum. And I gave various reasons why I believe that the healing of the man sick of the palsy actually took place in the synagogue. If that was the case, then it makes more sense of chapter 3 and verse 1 that he entered again into the synagogue, almost implying that it was the same sort of context as we've got in Mark chapter 2. The difference being, by that time he'd gone down to Jerusalem and had come back to the land of Galilee. And therefore I believe it was the synagogue in Capernaum, and we're told there was a man which had a withered hand. We're told nothing about the man. We're not given any background to him or whatever. Whether he was just one of the many in that time who obviously required healing and wanted obviously to see whether the master would heal them, or whether or not, brothers and sisters, he was specifically planted in that place by the Pharisees to see whether the master would heal him on the Sabbath day. I believe there is a very strong case to suggest that he was a plant. And I don't mean the recording brother of Streatley. I believe he'd been put there by the Pharisees to see whether the master would heal or not. I might be misjudging him completely. And if I am, no doubt you will forgive me, as the man will forgive me. But I believe there is some evidence to suggest that he'd been literally planted there to see whether or not this Sabbath controversy could continue. Be that as it may for a moment, let's just look at the situation. Verse 2, Mark chapter 3. And they watched him, whether he would heal him on the Sabbath day, that they might accuse him. That's one of the reasons for suggesting that he'd been put there. They watched him. Now, why would they be watching him, brothers and sisters, unless they knew the man was there anyway? There was obviously something specific. Whether this man was in a prominent position, whether or not he was sitting next to the Lord, whatever the circumstances, there seemed to be some link between this man with the withered hand and the fact they were watching Jesus to see whether he would heal on the Sabbath day. Now, it's situations like this which to me bring to light the wonder of the book of Psalms. Can we go back to Psalm 37? Because I know a lot of brethren get so much pleasure and enjoyment from the book of Psalms, and I don't think there's any denying that whatsoever. I sometimes personally struggle to see why all the various psalms have been written. Not because I don't have any pleasure out of them, but I sometimes struggle to get them all into sort of sequence or the reasons. But to me it's like when we look at Psalm 37, when we have phrases such as this, of verse 32, which brings the psalms to light. Psalm 37, verse 32, the wicked watcheth the righteous and seeketh to slay him. And if that isn't exactly what Mark 3 and verse 2 is saying, then I don't know what it is. And they're written back in the Psalms concerning the Master is the most wonderful statement, that the wicked watch the righteous and seek to slay him. And I believe there's exhortation there, brothers and sisters, for each one of us. If we, God willing, are part of the righteous, and I'm not trying to be presumptuous, then the wicked are watching us to see whether we practice what we preach, to whether there is a chink in our armour, to whether or not we are discrediting those very things that we say that we uphold. And they try to find some means where they might accuse us. You're a right one, saying this, that and the other. Look what you go out and do. But the Master, the intensity of their inspection of him day and night was to the point that in Mark chapter 3 and verse 2, they were to watch him. While we're there in the Psalms, can we just go to Psalm 38? Another, what I think, is a gem. Look at verse 12. They also that seek after my life lay snares for me. And they that seek my hurt speak mischievous things and imagine deceits all the day long. My second reason, not my last, my second reason, that the man was a plant. They also that seek after my life lay snares for me. As if they deliberately to see whether he would trip up at it, to see whether he would heal on the Sabbath day. And verse 2 of Mark chapter 3 says, that they might accuse him. Can we at this stage go to Luke's account? Verse 7 of Luke chapter 6 is virtually the same as what we've just read in Mark. The scribes and the Pharisees watched him, whether he would heal on the Sabbath day, that they might find an accusation against him. Luke had the point, but he knew their thoughts. He knew precisely what they were thinking. He obviously knew what was in man, but he knew their thoughts. And knowing their thoughts, I'd like us to come back to Mark's account now, verse 3 of chapter 3. He saith unto the man which had the withered hand, stand forth. Again, if you've got your marginal reference, arise, stand forth in the midst. Wherever this man was, wherever he was sitting, whatever he was doing, the Master now wants him to come out in full view of everybody. He wasn't just going to say to him in a quiet corner, you're healed. He wanted to bring him forth so that everybody could see him. And I believe that's the implication of this man with the withered hand. He wanted everybody to look upon him. I believe at that point there would be total embarrassment as to what he was going to do next. Can we go to Matthew's account in chapter 12? Verse 10, Matthew is fairly brief up to the point. Behold, there was a man which had his hand withered. They asked him, saying, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath day, that they might accuse him? They now had asked him a question, whether or not it was lawful to heal on the Sabbath day. And in verse 11, he said unto them, what man shall there be among you that shall have one sheep, and if it fall into pit on the Sabbath day, will he not lay hold on it and lift it out? How much then is a man better than a sheep? Wherefore it is lawful to do well on the Sabbath days. Again, you know, how could they answer that, brothers and sisters? What comment could they make? Can we go back to Luke's account? 8, so we can get the connection. I think it's necessary that we try and get the full weight of the three gospel accounts behind the incident. He knowing their thoughts, said unto the man which had the withered hand, rise up and stand forth in the midst. And he arose and stood forth. Then said Jesus unto them, I will ask you one thing. Is it lawful on the Sabbath days to do good or to do evil, to save life or to destroy it? Matthew has said, after giving the account of one sheep falling into a pit, Matthew says, it is lawful to do well on the Sabbath day. Luke adds the point that he asked them a question. Is it lawful to do good, to do evil, to save life or to destroy it? It's against the background of the sheep falling into the pit. Which man wouldn't be honest enough to say we're getting out of the pit? And therefore, is a man's life more worth than a sheep's? So if they were prepared to do good for the sheep on the Sabbath day, wasn't it right for him to do good for a man on the Sabbath day? Matthew says it is lawful. Luke says he asked them a question. Obviously both accounts are correct. He obviously stated a fact and then asked them what their thoughts were. When we come back to Mark chapter 3, Mark also poses his in the form of a question, but Mark gives us their answer, which the other two doesn't. Mark chapter 3 and verse 4, he said unto them, is it lawful to do good on the Sabbath days or to do evil, to save life or to kill? But they held their peace. There was no answer whatsoever. And really, if they were honest, there was an answer. Yes, they would have saved life. Yes, they would have done good. Every single one of them would have done good. There's no doubt about it, even for the sake of one sheep, was the man worth more than the sheep. Verse 5 of Mark chapter 3 goes on to say, when he had looked round about on them with anger, being grieved for the hardness of their hearts. With anger, brothers and sisters. Now we hear a lot about righteous anger. I'd rather have the Apostle Paul throw some light upon this thought of the Lord. Ephesians chapter 4. Verse 23, well 22 for connection, Ephesians 4, that you put off concerning the former conversation the old man which is corrupt according to the deceitful lust, be ye renewed in the spirit of your mind, that you put on the new man which after God is created in righteousness and true holiness, wherefore putting away lying, speak every man truth with his neighbour, for we are members one of another, be ye angry and sin not. Let not the sun go down upon thy wrath, neither give place to the devil. So the apostle is saying, be ye angry and sin not. What did he mean? Well again, can we go back to the book of Psalms? Verse 4, Psalm 4. Stand in awe and sit not. Commune with your own heart upon your own bed and be still. You'll notice this is a citation in your central margin, Ephesians 4, verse 26. The Septuagint version of which is, be angry and sin not. If you go to Psalm 7 and verse 11, I believe the explanation is given better by the psalmist than any words of us can say. Verse 11, God judges the righteous, and God is angry with the wicked every day. So the anger, brothers and sisters, is against wickedness. It's against the stubbornness. It's against the evil. It's against the sinfulness of man. Lot vexed his righteous soul day by day because of the wickedness and the horror of Sodom and Gomorrah. And that's what we are angry about, the deeds, the evilness of men. And yet, we're not to sin. So that we have righteous indignation against the things of evil. But we've got to make sure that we are not contaminated with it. That we do not fall into the same evil thoughts and deeds as they do. So if we're angry against them, then we make sure that we sin not. Because we've put off the old man. That's Ephesians 4. We've got rid of that old conversation. So how can we, if somebody said something blasphemous in our hearing, and we obviously comment about him, particularly when they take the name of God or the Lord Jesus in vain. You know, we might react, and we might react angrily if it persists. But we sin not to make sure that later on, even if we don't mouth the same words, we're not guilty of the same thing, that we are doing disservice and disloyalty to that holy name which we bear. So the man still was angry, and there was no question about it. The word is angry. He was angry, brethren and sisters, being grieved for the hardness of their hearts. He was indignant at their stubbornness, at their hard-heartedness, of their evil minds, because he knew their thoughts. That they hadn't got the courage, they hadn't got the guts, as we would say in modern language, to answer a straightforward question. Would you do good on the Sabbath or do evil in the sake of saving a sheep? And they refused. They were so bitter and so stubborn against the Lord. And he was angry and grieved for the hardness of their hearts. And therefore, brothers and sisters, there is a loving of righteousness, but a hating of wickedness. But if we can come back to the gospel record, can we go to Luke chapter 6 now? And verse 10, he looks round about them all. Verse 8 has already told us that he knew their thoughts. Mark has added that with anger he looked upon them. Luke says he looked upon them all. And I feel, brothers and sisters, the piercing eyes of the Lord would look upon every single one seated in the synagogue. Like we can with the benefit of speaking sometimes on the platform. You can look round at everyone to see those who have dozed off, those who are attentive, those whose minds are wandering, and you can look at them. And particularly on a Sunday night, if you've got young people, you can look at them, whether they're playing up or not. And just by a look will sometimes cause them to stop what they were doing. And I believe in a much greater way, the Master looked upon everyone, every single person. And I think there would be a silence there, brothers and sisters, which could have been felt as he looked upon them, knowing exactly what was in their minds. And he said unto the man, stretch forth your hand. And he did so. His hand was withered. He hadn't been able to use it. He couldn't stretch it forth. But he did. He did so. And his hand was restored whole as the other. His hand was restored whole as the other. He didn't touch him. He didn't have any contact with him at all. It was purely the words that he spoke. And they were all looking upon this man who'd got the withered hand now healed because he was there in the midst of them. So one minute the gaze of the Lord had been on all of them. The next minute he was saying to the man, stretch forth thy hand, and they saw it for their own eyes. They're in the synagogue, a place of worship, when they come to read the word of God. I wonder if any of them, brothers and sisters, recalled the scriptures which was relevant to this situation. I wonder how many of us recall the scriptures which are relevant to this situation. As if the Master, when he caused the man to put forth his hand and it was healed, I do not believe he let go of his gaze upon people. Because if we go back to the book of Isaiah in chapter 35, and as most speakers say, I know you're there before I've got there myself. But Isaiah chapter 35, which we tend to use solely as applicable to the kingdom, but obviously the work which the Master did during his ministry, which was obviously a prelude, was an insight as to what will be done in the kingdom, speaks in Isaiah chapter 35 and verse 3, strengthen ye the weak hands. Strengthen ye the weak hands. And confirm the feeble knees. Say to them that are of a fearful heart, be strong, fear not. Behold, your God will come with vengeance, even God with a recompense. He will come and save you. And there they'd seen the weak hands strengthened. And as he gazed upon them, he was saying to them of a fearful heart, be strong. Don't be frightened to answer. Be strong enough to answer according to your conscience, because God has promised he will come and save you by the very one who can strengthen weak hands. Luke chapter 6. The reaction of the Pharisees was verse 11. They were filled with madness and communed one with another what they might do to Jesus. Mark's record, chapter 3 and verse 6, says, the Pharisees went forth and straightway took counsel with the Herodians. What strange bedfellows. They hated the Herodians because the Herodians wanted to side with the government. But we notice in our readings yesterday in Luke chapter 20, the Herodians were posing questions to the Master. And they consulted with the Herodians against him how they might destroy him. What day was it? The Sabbath day. Was it lawful to kill on the Sabbath day? And yet they were plotting. No doubt it was an unlawful meeting, because no doubt one of their traditions would have forbid a meeting on a Sunday to consult like this. Yet they consulted, brothers and sisters, to kill him. A man whom they had witnessed with their own eyes, cure a man, without even touching him, by the very word that he spoke, was sufficient to heal him. We go back to Matthew's account in chapter 12. Verse 14. The Pharisees went out and held a council against him. A council. Does that imply the full Sanhedrin? 70 elders were assembled, It's difficult, as I'm sure Brother Howe would say, to get an arranging brethren's meeting after a Sunday night at times. And he's only got sort of six or seven brethren to organise. If it was a full council,
at Karakoram all there.
And he was up in Capernaum. So incensed were they that he'd obviously caused something which was so horrible and evil in their minds that he filled them with madness, said Luke, that they wanted to do something, and that quickly. Now, brothers and sisters, we've given two suggestions as to whether this man was really there just to be cured, or whether he'd been planted by the Pharisees and the Sadducees. I'm going to give you the third reason. Ooh. I'll give you what I believe is the basis of the third reason for you to ponder for homework, so that we'll draw the conclusions next time. 1 Kings 13. You remember when the man from Judah, the prophet from Judah, who we're not told who he was, we're just told that he was a man of God out of Judah, came to Jeroboam to come and prophesy concerning Josiah. And it was 340 years later that Josiah was born. And yet this man of God in 1 Kings 13 spoke of Josiah being the one who obviously would destroy the false altars that had been erected by Jeroboam. And he's mentioned in verse 2 by name, Josiah. Jeroboam obviously went to take hold of the man of God, verse 4. And as he did so, his hand withered. And the man of God cured his withered hand. That's the only incident I know in the Old Testament where there was the curing of the withered hand in this situation. I believe the Master was using the analogy of 1 Kings 13 to drive home to them a vital lesson. And that's why I believe the third reason is the man was a plant, because he turned the situation upon them. Think about it. We've got 4 weeks, because we're not meeting next time, because we won't be here. And therefore, you know, you should have worked it out easily by then, because I do believe, genuinely, that the Master was using the basis of 1 Kings 13 to drive home a vital lesson for them. And I believe it was that which caused them to be filled with madness. That's simple. Thank you.